stories, a military base belonging to the U.S.-led coalition comes under a rocket attack in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Israeli forces arrest an Al Jazeera reporter in a Palestinian neighborhood in Jerusalem on Quds, drawing condemnation from press freedom advocates. Also ahead, the UN Secretary General has strongly condemned the killing of nearly 140 civilians in Burkina Faso. Welcome to the program. A military base belonging to the U.S.-led coalition has come under a rocket attack in the high-security green zone of the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. A spokesman for the coalition said a rocket landed near the Baghdad Diplomatic Support Center without causing any injuries or damage. The source of the rocket was not immediately known. Washington's military and diplomatic buildings have been increasingly targeted in recent months in Iraq amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Israeli forces have attacked a sit-in protest in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem al-Quds. Israeli police arrested a correspondent covering a gathering for the Al Jazeera news network and damaged her crew's equipment. The move sparked condemnation from press freedom advocates. The rally was held to mark the 54th anniversary of the Naxa Day, or Day of Setback. The day is commemorated on June the 5th every year to mark the displacement of Palestinian people from the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, following the Six-Day War in 1967. In Jordan, several security forces are injured following what the Interior Ministry called an armed attack near the capital, Amman. The ministry said the security personnel were injured near Queen Alia International Airport, some 30 kilometers south of Amman. It said the forces were dealing with riots, burning vehicles, and shootings by a group of people in the Naour district. No further information has been provided by Jordanian officials. Yemen's Ansarullah movement blames the U.S. for the deteriorating humanitarian crisis in the impoverished country. It also says the U.S. has prolonged the war in Yemen by supporting Saudi Arabia's blockade on the impoverished nation. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
Yemen Ansarullah movement dismissed as baseless an accusation by the U.S. which mentioned the movement as the main cause behind the war in Yemen. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued a statement accusing the Ansarullah movement of prolonging the conflict and worsening Yemen's humanitarian crisis by attacking Marib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen.
The accusation of the U.S. State Department against the Ansarullah movement is part of a larger plan to stop Yemen's army advancement towards the city of Marib. Yemenis will not give in to these pressures. The mediator must be neutral, but the U.S. is biased towards the Saudi-led coalition.
Yemen said the USB's major responsibility for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen as it supports the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. They called on the international community to prosecute the U.S. for committing war crimes against the women and the children of Yemen.
The U.S. State Department is not in a position to accuse Ansarullah movement because the war in Yemen has been led by the U.S. Therefore, the U.S. is involved in the war and cannot serve as a mediator. We call on the international community to put the U.S. on trial over committing war crimes against Yemeni children and women.
Earlier, the head of the Yemeni negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman said the other parties are haggling over the suffering of millions of Yemenis for military gains, adding that it is the right of all Yemenis to obtain food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Yemenis say the U.S. has no right to blame them as it is one of the parties of the current war on their country. They believe that bargaining over their suffering is a clear violation of the international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Seven candidates for Iran's upcoming presidential vote have attended a televised debate. It is the first out of three presidential debates, which centered on economy. Yusuf Jaloli has a report.
After days of campaigning for the upcoming presidential vote in Iran, candidates now stand toe-to-toe for a face-off. On Saturday, the seven runners attended the first televised debate, which was aired live on national television. Themed with economy, the first debate required the candidates to answer common questions, ranging from monetary policies to domestic production and boosting exports.
In order to boost domestic production, we need to reduce the taxes levied on our producers and in return increase the taxes on unproductive businesses, such as real estate or forex trading.
8 years ago, in the same place, I showed you a 10,000 rial banknote and warned you that if the current trend went on, our national currency would collapse. We need to take a different approach than using people's pockets to solve the government's problems.
We have prepared a package that consists of 213 projects. 51 of them are focused on harnessing inflation and controlling the prices.
When we speak about eliminating poverty, we're not just talking about basic rights, but it's also about entertainment and health policies. I have a comprehensive plan that can tackle these issues.
We need to turn our focus toward a 500 million strong market that exists in the region and not our 80 million strong domestic market. I mean, we need to strengthen our regional diplomacy and open up to the world to attract investment.
The debate started with random questions to each of the candidates, but got raucous after Abdel Nasser Hemati picked on the other contenders, saying they're running to promote poverty rather than wealth.
Unlike the other candidates, I don't like to resort to lying to attract more votes. None of them is speaking of the distribution of wealth, but increasing poverty. I will pay equal attention to both creating wealth and its fair distribution.
Hemati's comment was not left unanswered, as Ali Reza Zarqani lashed out at him by reminding him of his poor performance as the head of the Central Bank of Iran, blaming him for the unprecedented devaluation of the national currency, the rial, which is currently traded at 240,000 against the U.S. dollar.
You have dealt an irreparable blow to the national currency, yet you accuse us of spreading poverty. You have already increased poverty during your tenure, while I speak of national production and boosting it. So please stop making accusations.
There are still two debates to go. The second and third debates will take place on Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will investigate the candidates' cultural and political policies.
Well, the debate offers an opportunity for each of the candidates to try to stand out and make the best impression to voters. It also gives a chance to the public to weigh up all the choices in one go. Yet, it's still too soon to judge about who stands a better chance to win the race, since the rivalry is still on. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran has condemned a UN decision to temporarily revoke Tehran's voting rights in the General Assembly over its dues to the world body. Tehran argues it has paid its dues to the world body regularly, and it's the economic sanctions that have made payments increasingly difficult for the country.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states. He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass-starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has obviously religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions.
The UN says Iran needs to pay over $16.2 million to have its voting rights restored. This is while, under Article 19 of the UN Charter, the General Assembly has the authority to determine whether the failure to pay the dues has been beyond the country's control, in which case it can allow the country to continue to vote. But considering that sanctions against Iran have been one of the most severe against any nation, why hasn't the world body given Iran a waiver on its voting rights?
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the US blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned, no stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate that conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impact of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
As many as 1,000 pro-Palestine protesters have created a human wall to block an Israeli cargo ship from unloading at the port of Oakland in the U.S. Israeli ship that docked on Friday morning remained fully loaded, with cranes idle as longshore workers refused to cross the protesters' picket lines. The demonstrators carried signs and waved Palestinian flags outside the port, blocking truck traffic from four marine terminals. The move was part of a week-long international Block the Boat campaign, in which activists are mobilizing to prevent Israeli ships from docking at ports around the world. The campaign is in response to Israel's recent assault on Gaza, which killed at least 248 Palestinians, or people, including at least 67 children. Activist and commentator Nick Ayala says movements like the Block the Boat campaign help raise awareness of the Palestinians' plight around the world.
this campaign is important in specifically radicalizing and raising the consciousness of the workers in a lot of these ports, because again, at least here in the United States, the situation is a bit unique in that a lot of these protests and these pickets are occurring not in the unions themselves. Sometimes they take part and they show solidarity, but the leadership and the organizing is coming from Palestinian communities and Palestinian organizations, Arab organizations, who go to these ports to strike or to protest these freighters. We saw, I think it was only just a few weeks ago, where similar things were happening in South Africa again, where they were blocking Israeli ships. And in Italy, you saw unions coming together to essentially stop Israeli ships or stop the freighters from being loaded and then sent to Israel. Here in the United States, it's interesting in that, again, as I mentioned, it's the Palestinian organizations that are taking that leadership role. But that's important because what it does do is, like I said, it raises the consciousness of the workers at these ports, making them realize that, you know, there is a connection between what is happening in Gaza, what is happening in Palestine, and the commerce or the freighter or just the regular everyday work that we tend to take for granted here in the United States.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has strongly condemned the massacre of civilians in Burkina Faso's volatile north. Guterres' spokesman said the UN underscores the urgent need for the international community to redouble support for the fight against violent extremism. Stéphane Dujarric also said that the UN fully supports the authorities in their efforts to overcome the threats to peace, stability, and unity in the country. This comes after militants killed at least 138 civilians in two Burkinabe villages in the deadliest attack since 2015. No group has claimed responsibility for the carnage, but Al-Qaeda-linked groups are known to be operating in the region. Burkina Faso, along with neighboring Mali and Niger, has come under frequent terrorist attacks in the past year. In other news, at least three people have been killed in northern Iraq during a Turkish airstrike on a camp housing Kurdish refugees. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had earlier warned Iraq that Ankara would clean up the refugee camp, which it says provides a haven for Kurdish militants. Turkey has ramped up attacks on bases of the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK, in northern Iraq over the past year. The operation mainly focuses on a strip of territory several kilometers inside the Iraqi border. In a separate incident, five Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga fighters were killed and four wounded in a PKK ambush in the town of Amedi in the northern Kurdistan region.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Thousands of ambulance crews in England will be given body cameras after a sharp rise in attacks on National Health Service staff treating patients, the government has announced. Data shows that 3,569 ambulance staff were physically assaulted by members of the public last year, 30% more than in 2016-2017. It is hoped that the body-worn cameras, which have been trialled in London and the northeast of England, will deter and document attacks. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sarah Marsh. The piece is titled, Ambulance Crews in England to Get Body Cameras After 30% Rise in Assaults. Stay with us for more of Sarah Marsh's article. of ambulance crews in England will be given body cameras after a sharp rise in attacks on NHS staff treating patients. The British government has announced. Data shows that 3,569 ambulance staff were physically assaulted by members of the public last year, 30% more than in 2016-2017. It is hoped that the body-worn cameras, which have already been trialled in London and the northeast of England, will deter and document physical assaults and attacks. The cameras will be given to crews in 10 ambulance trusts across the country. Medics will wear the cameras and be able to press a button to start recording if patients or the public become aggressive or abusive, and the film will be given to the police where needed. The plans come after successful trials in London and the northeast of England. Prerana Issar, the chief people officer for the National Health Service, said, "Every member of our dedicated and hard-working NHS staff has the fundamental right to be safe at work, and it is our priority to eliminate violence and abuse, which we will not tolerate. As well as reducing the number of incidents towards our staff, these cameras are a vital step towards ensuring our people feel safe too." Initial findings show the cameras make staff feel safer and can help to de-escalate situations where they are faced with someone being aggressive. Green, the clinical service manager at the North East England Ambulance Service, said, "Staff safety is one of our highest priorities. If we are unable to protect our staff, we are unable to provide a service that fits for purpose for the public. The availability of body-worn cameras for our staff is something that we have championed for a long time, and so we are delighted to have led the trial to help implement them nationally." Darren Green added, "Nobody comes to work to be abused, but especially not by the people they have come to help and to serve. Sadly, these cameras are needed now more than ever." Gary Watson, an emergency ambulance crew member who works for the London Ambulance Service and is based in Croydon in South London, has been wearing a body camera as part of a trial at 4 ambulance stations in South and North London. He was violently assaulted by a patient in January of 2018 whilst on duty and suffered a torn ligament and serious injuries to his face, throat and the neck. 2 other medical staff were also injured and a 4th was badly shaken. A man was convicted for the assault and received a suspended sentence. Gary Watson, an emergency ambulance crew member, said, "These cameras are indeed needed, and wearing one makes me feel safer. They act as a deterrent and will also help provide evidence if there is an attack. We go to work to help people, not to be assaulted by them. It's disgusting that a minority think it's okay to behave in such a violent way."
Food for thought.
Salam, and today, on the 57th anniversary of historic 15th of Khordad uprising, launched by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, to ready run of domestic despotism and foreign hegemony, here is a prophecy from the Prophet's seventh infallible heir, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, that some believe is a pointer to the events in Iran. A man from Qom will rise and invite people towards truth. Around him will gather people like slabs of iron, who will not be shaken by strong winds and storms, and will neither get tired of war, nor will they back down, and they have trust in Allah. The outcome is for the pious.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of this program, The Man Who Changed the World and Who Shaped All Our Tomorrows. The program, of course, is about Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And we've, in the previous programs, have discussed the personality of the Imam. We spoke a little bit about his life with our expert in the studio, and we've also mentioned several important points that we brought out of this biographical series on this very great man who is not only the father of the Islamic Revolution, but also the father of what we can call the Islamic Awakening. Because, of course, the consequences and the impact of what Imam Khomeini did here in Iran, of course, is still playing out after his passing away. So, once again, I'd like to introduce our expert who helps us in this discussion and this debate about this very great man, and that is Dr. Hassani, who is also a researcher and an academic. And first of all, I'd like to say salam and a very warm welcome to you on the program.
Salamu alaikum. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you, brother. May God's blessing be upon you and your family.
Thank you.
Brother, I was listening to you very carefully. Mm-hmm. The name of the program, the title is The Man Who Changed the World.
Yes.
I was going to suggest something here.
Yes.
The man who changed the world and still is.
It still is, yes, yes.
That brings me to another subject. Mm-hmm. That, remember the one of the programs, I said something to the fact that speaking about Imam Khomeini, mm-hmm. it's very easy and very difficult at the same time.
It is easy. It is.
Because if you ask me, mm-hmm. I would like for you to, you know, jump in and ask me tough questions.
Yes.
I'm not going to claim to have the same answer that you may expect to hear.
Sure.
But I can promise you this. If I don't know the answer, I go and do my research, come back.
Sure.
To give a good answer in order to be validated mm-hmm. with the references that you were talking about, mm-hmm. Quran and Itra.
Yes.
Remember, we were talking about this in the program,
right.
in the last program.
Yes.
The man who changed the world and still is.
This is
the problem that enemies of Islam have with the character of Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Exactly. I mean, what I was going to ask you, and to be honest, you know, we're really referring to a book that has been recently been published on Imam Khomeini, and it's an anthology. It's the composition of a variety of academics, of scholars, of people who are analysts in this particular field of studying great figures of history, the people who really shape events. And of course, you know, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, has had such an impact that this anthology is about 400 pages compiled by people of international repute, academics and professors of various expertise who are literally gobsmacked, if I could put it that way, mm-hmm. by the Imam, who was a humble teacher, a student of the Hawza, a man of great purity, of great spirituality. And we discussed that in the previous programs. We discussed this aspect of his being close to his beloved, and he's written poetry accordingly. There are poems by Imam Khomeini about speaking about this mystical aspect of this relationship that he wanted with God. Which is very rare, of course, because you and I were discussing before that in the late century, religion was something that was basically put in a closet.
Was it taboo?
Well, I mean, it was not something relevant.
I mean, if you really tried to practice religion back then,
right?
You know, you would, in some different circumstances, you should be ashamed of yourself, according to them.
Yeah, exactly. No, this is.
You should feel bad.
Well, I mean,
why are you praying?
Exactly. I mean, the thing, you don't pray, this is what they used to say. Yeah, in terms of the West, I mean, as far as you and I, because of course you've lived in America and I've lived in the United Kingdom for most of my life. The thing that draws to us is that, you know, this was a personal thing. You know, that, you know, if you have a spirituality, it's like a phase that you go through,
mm-hmm.
right? But Imam Khomeini was the embodiment of one of the great divine religions that have been revealed to the world, which is Islam. And he comes out of that tradition. And he's made such an impact that he's left the rest of the world still searching and going through all their databases again about exactly what has this man done. And, you know, as you say, as you quite rightly pointed out, that the title of the program is The Man Who Changed the World. And what we are puzzled by is the ingredients that make up Imam Khomeini, because we've touched on these aspects of his personality, his character, his courageousness, his bravery in terms of speaking out against Zulm. As far as Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, he was doing his duty as far as the agenda or as far as the briefing that was concerned from the Quran.
And let's not forget the ingredients, the main ingredients was divine teaching. I'm going to refer to this.
Yeah, exactly. And what I'm saying here is that in terms of this connection between the Prophet's legacy, which the Imam reiterated again in his will at the end of his life, and he says, and he begins by that tradition, that very famous hadith that we quote over and over again, that there are two things that the Holy Prophet was leaving behind. The one was the Quran, and the other was the itrati, the family.
Two heavy things or two valuable things at the same time.
At the same time.
Right.
And the Imam lives up to both of these things.
That's why he became Imam.
That's why he became Imam. So, the question is, why so much emphasis on this legacy for the rest of the Muslim world? And why is, in spite of all the resources that are available to the West, and it was to the East as well, in terms of their intelligence, in terms of their analysis, in terms of their academia, and of course, you know, we don't belittle them in any way. When we speak of Harvard, we speak of Oxford, we speak with respect for these institutions. Yet, why don't they have an answer for Imam Khomeini? Why are they struggling?
My answer to that important question is this: because they are acting.
Right.
If you act, you cannot be yourself. Imam Khomeini was not acting.
Right.
He was himself.
Mm-hmm.
This is one thing. The main ingredients that I said a couple seconds ago,
mm-hmm.
divine teaching,
right.
You talk about Quran here,
mm-hmm.
and who's gonna teach us Quran? Prophet.
Yes.
According
but
to Quran.
But you don't have Prophet just now.
Well, but he has done his mission
mm-hmm.
during 23 years of hardship.
So that we wouldn't be without him.
Because he did it because we shouldn't go astray after him.
Exactly. And I was
to stay on the right path. And Imam Khomeini, peace
mm-hmm.
be upon him, did that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to give you so many references from Quran, okay?
Right, go ahead. Go ahead.
Let me give you examples.
Right, let's,
because when
let's
you,
put this into a context.
When you study Imam Khomeini's life,
yeah.
okay,
mm-hmm.
this is not a lullaby for us.
Yeah.
This is something for us to pick the reference, the passage, the address. Why are we supposed to do this or that? When you hear about what Imam, let me give you one example.
Sure.
It is said that Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him, when he was thirsty,
mm-hmm.
you know, asking for a glass of water, whatever,
mm-hmm.
okay, he drank half of it. He put a piece of napkin on top
mm-hmm.
to save the rest of water
mm-hmm.
for later on. Why he did that? We don't think about it. We said, oh,
mm-hmm.
we're looking for some different reasons. No, we have to get back to the passage, to the divine teaching. Quran tells us, Kulu vashrabu wa la tusrifu.
Mm-hmm.
Eat, drink,
mm-hmm.
but don't waste. Imam Khomeini was not acting for someone to take a picture or later on, you know, write it in a book.
Yeah.
To be a biography of him or whatever. Mm-hmm. He really believed in this ayah, that wasting the benefit, the gifts of God is not good.
Well, I want
as simple as that.
I want to interrupt you there just for a second, because what you point out there, you know, we hear this cliche over and over again. Islam is a way of life.
And but the problem with that is we don't get tired of it.
Yeah, this is a way of life. Islam is a way of life. But what I want to say is, how many of us actually live that way of life or have understood that way of life? I mean, the action you've just described there for a moment with the half glass of water in the napkin, I mean, also reminds me of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, where he says, when you're doing your ablutions, you can do it with a glass of water.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You don't need to open the tap and let it run and wash your face and have a kind of semi-bath before you go for your prayer.
Because if you do so, if you waste it, that's some kind of selfishness.
So exactly. So in other words, Imam Khomeini is literally taking what he's understood from the Quran, and although was not a masoom, but he's trying to live up to the standard of the infallibles, the 12 imams who succeeded the Holy Prophet in terms of that teaching, because that discipline is extremely important. And if you don't have it, you can't live this way of a life of Islam.
That's why he was successful. That's why he ruled over the hearts, not bodies. This is the task of Islam. Before you conquer a country or a land, you have to gain the hearts. This is very difficult. Imam was not masoom by any means, but this is not the point. Mm. I mean, in Shia belief, we only have 14 of them.
Yes.
But let me ask you this. Hazrat Zainab, peace be upon her, she wasn't masoom in this category.
No.
But what kind of wrongdoing she did?
Exactly.
This is a question. This is why I'm trying to say, to relay the message. If you read Quran, in every different passage of teaching, it tells you why don't you think in so many different levels.
Yes.
We have tafakkur. Okay, this is the beginning.
Yes.
Then we have ta'aqul. It goes to a higher level. Then we have tadabbur. You have to put the pieces in order, one behind each other. In other words, you have to make a caravan of thinking, of rationalizing, of understanding, deep understanding of divine teaching. And Imam did that successfully. Imam was not impeccable in that sense, but he climbed to the summit and to the top of all the perfection that we could expect from a human being. This is my point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can give you so many different... Look, there's a verse in Quran in chapter Anfal, the spoils of war.
Spoils of war, yes. This is chapter 8, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The verse 29 says, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O those who believe. After that, there is a conditional statement. In tattaqullah, if you fear God by staying away from what he prohibits you from not doing, and do what he supposed to expect from you, so you become a pious. When you become a pious, there is a reward. In tattaqullah, what's the reward? Yaj'al lakum furqana. God gives you a power of distinction.
Right.
Imam was a distinctive man. This is a divine teaching that I'm talking about. And Prophet, peace be upon him, passed this to us. Why? Because his divine mission was complete.
Yeah.
He did exactly what God told him to do.
I mean, the thing is that, as you quite rightly point out, that this very important factor, that Imam Khomeini is actually living this divine teaching, which gives him this naturalness, this sincerity, this purity, both of his words and his action.
And by the way, he didn't do it for other people to see him.
Exactly.
He did it because he believed it.
He believes it. And
that's the difference.
That's the decisive factor.
That's why I keep saying he was not acting. He was himself. And by himself, I mean he was human first. Then, of course, he He was a faithful. Mm. He was a Muslim. Mm. He was a Shia, because all different levels, you know, the expectation goes higher.
Yeah.
He raised the bar for himself, Brother Ajaz. He raised the bar for himself. This is very important to understand.
And he was doing that to the last moment of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Raising the bar.
Let me give you another instant of his life.
Please.
Okay, he was walking in his surrounding. One small garden, one small flower. How many of us pay attention to a small flower, the changing of how it grows? Imam did that. So for us to see that, to read that, is one thing. But to think about it is different. Mm. Because he saw that particular small flower as ayah of Allah, as the sign of Allah.
Exactly.
The color, the smell, the beauty of the flower. Mm. He felt it. Because Allah told him to think about his gifts, his creation. Remember the incident that is famous, that one of the correspondents, the media, asked him in the plane, what is your feeling
after?
Yeah,
that was John Simpson of the BBC.
What? The answer was what? Nothing.
Nothing. Each.
My question to you is this. Why he didn't ask him, what do you mean by nothing? Think about what I just said.
Yeah. He didn't come back to him on that.
He didn't come back to him. Yeah. Why? Because he wasn't thinking. Then later on he took it in a negative way.
Way?
And talk about it.
Yeah.
This is my point.
Yeah.
And you can elaborate on this if you want. By thinking.
Mm-hmm.
What is your feeling after 15 years in being in exile?
Mm-hmm.
You're going back to your country, your homeland.
Mm-hmm.
What is your feeling? Imam says nothing. Because besides Allah, for Allah, from Allah, to Allah, he sees nothing. That's what he meant. Anything else is just a tool.
Yeah.
It's a device. It's not the purpose. It's not the main goal for Imam.
No.
Because the way he recognized his creator,
he
can see things different than other people. This is the difference.
Exactly. And this is
why
this
that news reporter, why didn't he ask him, what do you mean by nothing? He could explain.
Yeah.
My answer to you is this, because he didn't want to know.
He didn't want to know because he was afraid of what was going to be said.
Of course, because if you ask him one question, you know, he gives you another one.
He was afraid if he went into
Brother
that.
Ajaz, there's no end to it.
Yeah, there's no end to it. Because
if you're attached to Islam, if you're a true believer, there is no end for you.
No.
The sky's the limit.
The sky's the limit. But the thing is that what the secular West, if I can put it that way, or the fact that the West has, in a sense, gone for secularism and abandoned their religiosity in many ways and spirituality in many ways, it's very hard for them to stomach what Imam Khomeini was saying over those period of the revolution, in the early days of the revolution. And, you know, that's what I come back to this anthology.
My point on that is this. Back then, you could justify that it was something new. Something new was going on.
Yeah.
But how about right now, 34 years later on?
But I would go further than that. I wouldn't even say it was something new. I would say
no, from their own perspective.
From their perspective, I'll give you this, because the headline in the paper said, you know, as soon as Imam Khomeini had landed at the Furudga, at the airport of Mehrabad, that he said in Tehran, it says 1,000 after 1,400 years, Islam is back. I mean, that's the headline
Islam
in the British
the
papers, which
Islam
means
Islam was back the way we could see it.
Exactly, but the
Islam always was on the.
That's the way Imam Khomeini, in this anthology, what he's done for all the academics and scholars who were so busy spending billions of dollars of taxpayers' money on justifying the postmodern world.
Mm-hmm.
And the world that we are in at the moment, which we now see is falling apart, also thanks to many aspects that we'll discuss later on in later programs about how Imam Khomeini could have this insight into seeing the end of the East as well as the West in terms of the civilization as they know it. But as far as what we are seeing at the moment, even in this moment in time after what Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, has done, that in the smallest of actions, as you say, in one word where he said heech,
nothing.
They were quite well aware of
what
that heech
was. So
no, let me finish this point, because the thing is that in that heech, they knew perfectly well what that meant.
That one particular because word, they, nothing, you can write books about it.
Exactly, because this word heech is saying, and that's what John Simpson was afraid of and didn't want to carry on the conversation. And this is what this anthology is also compiled about, that it's going to force him to think about God. And that is where we are at the moment, that mm-hmm. you and I are discussing Imam Khomeini, the man who changed the world.
And it still is.
And still is. But what are we really discussing here? What is the real topic behind what we're discussing here? Because the Imam loves Allah. And that love that he has for God is something that he wants to instill in all of us.
And that love comes from true understanding.
Yeah.
A deep one.
So
what we call ma'rifah.
From the passages of the Quran, mm-hmm. as we are saying that, we say that Islam is a way of life. But really, are we doing any true justice to living that way of life as the Imam demonstrated that, look, I am a person who has lived this book, and
brother,
look what it's done.
We should try. He set the example. You know, we haven't seen any prophets. Mm-hmm. Have you?
I haven't seen any, no.
Apostle?
But if I want...
We saw Imam Khomeini.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I said it's easy to talk about Khomeini, because we think we know him. This
we
is
think
my point.
We know him, yeah.
We think we know him,
no.
So it makes it easy for us.
Yeah.
We know him. Why?
Yeah.
Because we live at the same era, the same time that he did.
Yeah, but we
most of us.
But we didn't grasp.
We didn't.
But
we didn't grasp the importance of
how he lived,
where he was coming from, how he lived, the root of the whole thing. And why is it difficult to understand Imam Khomeini? Because we don't try.
Yeah.
It is difficult. It's almost impossible for Western media, Western mentality. That is.
Yeah.
In order to understand why, because in order to meet someone, you have to take the first step. You have to meet in the middle.
Yeah.
He comes to you, you have to go to him at the same time.
Yeah.
And this is how God works. He said, if you take one step for me, I would help you.
Yeah, I'll take 10 steps towards you.
Exactly. That's why when you do something good, he rewards you 10 times.
10 times.
Bigger.
But
if you do something bad, he only punishes you.
Yeah.
If he doesn't forgive you.
Yeah.
This is the point. This is the stuff that we need to talk about.
Yeah.
And the list goes on.
Yeah.
We can talk about Imam Khomeini as long as we can live. Why? Because Quran is limitless.
Exactly.
Because Etra is limitless.
Exactly.
Because they set the right path for us. On this, I can give you so many different passages and action that Imam took. Remember Shuart Nazir?
Yes, I remember.
Edward?
Yeah.
The Soviet Union Foreign Minister.
Remember
Secretary. After Imam sent a mission,
yeah.
a divine mission, I
yeah.
should say.
Yeah.
Okay, one of the big scholar of the Hosa in Qom.
Yeah.
He sent with the message in order to explain it to Mr. Gorbachev. He didn't listen. Later on, he admitted.
Yeah.
That was one of his biggest mistakes in his life.
It says that also here, it quotes him from this anthology. He said, that was the biggest mistake of my life. I wish I had paid more attention to that delegation when they left that message, because he says when the Soviet Empire really started to disintegrate, I remembered that letter.
Mm-hmm. But that was too late. So one of the divine teaching, Brother Edwards, is that to be on the right track at the right time. Imam was at the right time, acting at the right time. He wasn't late. When Shuart Nazir came to him with the message of Mr. Gorbachev,
I think we pointed out.
You know what he did?
Yeah.
The way that he met him. Mm. He didn't sit Imam Khomeini. Mm. I tell you why. Anything you hear about Khomeini, ask yourself why. Why he did that? Just like the example I gave
sure.
you about the glass of water. Why he did that? There is a reason behind it. The reason you should look for to understand in Quran and Itra, in the life of the impeccables.
Yes.
When Shuart Nazir came to him, he didn't sit on a chair for Shuart Nazir to arrive into the room, and for Imam Khomeini, as the leader of Muslims of the world, to stand up in front of someone who's not a Muslim. Think about what I just said.
Yeah.
Because you talk about the izzah here. You talk about the leadership. Okay, he was humble. You mentioned something, you know,
yes,
a couple minutes ago.
Yeah.
You said he was humble. Mm. He was humble because God told him to be humble.
Exactly.
There's a passage in Quran,
yes,
telling his prophet, peace be upon him. He said, when you walk on the earth, don't be arrogant. Don't walk like a king. Imam was humble with the, how should I say this, with faithful. He wasn't humble with America. He said America cannot do a damn thing. He was tough with them because, again, in Quran, God tells us, you know,
be hard against the unbelievers.
Prophet is the messenger of God, okay, our prophet, peace be upon him. Whoever is with him, ashidda alal kuffar, tough with the enemy of God, with the blasphemous.
Yes.
But at the same time, rohama'o bainahum, be gentle, be kind, be meek. He was meek. With people, ordinary people.
Exactly.
But he couldn't budge in front of infidels, in front of God.
No.
He shouldn't. He couldn't.
Couldn't.
He couldn't.
No.
Because that was against his belief. And the list goes on, brother. He didn't stand up in front of him. So the set was like this, that Shuarnazar was sitting.
Yes.
Imam arrived into the room. Think about that. From the position of Izzah, undefeatable position that God gives every single faithful, if you follow the path. You see my point here? Anything he did, anything you read in a book, don't just read it because it's a story of his life, which is good. And we should respect. But think about the reason behind it. That's why it makes, it makes Imam Khomeini unique, I should say.
Exactly.
And he was in that sense.
Because, I mean, this is the thing that he's trying, Imam Khomeini, you know, as a teacher. And he is a teacher for us, and for, as you say, for as long as we are going to have this discussion, which is beyond our own lifetimes. But in the next session, in the next program, I'd like to concentrate more on this aspect, that as you say,
you can pick from any part of his life.
Any part of
his life. And I can find a reference for you.
Yeah, but I'd like to talk more about the fact that he's living the Quran in this modern, postmodern era, in the context of the end of the 20th century. And yet, he's not part of that time. He's ahead of that time. He's not in that
That's
context.
That's a good subject, yeah.
He's not in that context. So I'd like to go more into that aspect and the other aspect of the fact that for the Muslim world as well, which we need to discuss as well, is that why did he emphasize this hadith Thaqalain? Beware. He's fully aware that there are other schools of...
In his will and last testament.
Yeah, there are other schools of Muslim thought that, of course, as a jurisprudent, as a walayat al-faqih, he is an expert on this aspect, but he emphasizes this, and we need to look into that, that why the imam, even through the process of this
And we
Islam,
should keep that in mind
this process of Islamic awakening that we're seeing now is so important, even for this particular movement as it's happening at this juncture. Thank you very much, Dr. Hasni, really, for you know, being on the program today.
Thank
and
you
I really,
for having me.
I really appreciate your valuable contribution, and we'll hopefully discuss further these aspects in the next program.
God,
so thank you.
We'll do that.
Thank you for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. I hope you enjoyed the program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessing of Allah be upon you all.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
The light.
A Brazilian artist has found a way to reuse plastic bags in a very creative way, making something beautiful. Eduardo Sroa turns recycled shreds of plastic into real pieces of artwork. He picks up the material from city streets and rivers. Without using a drop of paint, Sroa recreates paintings by Picasso, Van Gogh, and other famous artists. He says his goal is to draw attention to plastic pollution.
I present this series as a product that does not have paint, except for what has already been processed into plastic by the industry. It does not have glue. It is a box that was built, and inside I press and condense it. I make an accumulated cluster of plastic bags that ends up creating this image that you see.
Sura's exhibition is due to open in Sao Paulo in the coming months. His previous works were also